Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the What's Up podcast, recorded on the 17th of June 2016. Today's episode, we're going to talk about LISA Pathfinder and the LIGO experiment looking for gravitational waves, and a little bit about Moon Express. People talking about it will be myself, Martin Black, an optical engineer who designs next generation astronomical instruments.
I'm Alistair Bruce, I'm a third year PhD student. I study active galactic nuclei.
And I'm William Taylor, I'm an instrument scientist, so I work with engineers and scientists to build stuff.
So William, do you want to kick us off by talking a little bit about these recent gravitational wave discoveries?
Yes, so this is another exciting result coming out of the rather wonderful LIGO detectors in America. So this is a system to look for these ripples in space-time caused by exciting cataclysmic events like black holes merging, which hopefully people saw in the press when the first discovery was announced, which was two whopping great big black holes, like 30 times the size of the sun, crashing into each other. And this sent a fair amount of energy, shall we say, sort of whizzing across the universe, which after a billion years finally came whizzing through the detector system in America. And excitingly, as we'd expect, but it's still good to see it again, they have discovered another similar event, slightly smaller this time, 14 solar masses and 8, I think, two slightly smaller black holes, still pretty big black holes when you think about it, which have sort of spiraled in together, and then in their final moments when they kind of coalesce into one big black hole, they send out a lot of energy. And when we say a lot of energy, the amount of energy this one sent out was about the same as all the energy in the mass of the sun converted. So if you took the mass of the sun and converted it into energy and sent this out across the universe, it's quite a significant amount. I'm not talking about sort of the energy as in like the output, like the heat or whatever from the sun. We're talking about if you turned the mass of the sun directly into energy, mm-hmm. So the wonderful E equals MC squared equation. It's a huge amount of energy. I think last time when it was something like 3 times the mass for the last one, and they said that's more energy, 50 times more energy than all the stars in the entire universe, distributed in a fraction of a second in this event. So
it's quite impressive. I do like that somebody has the job of being like that statistics person who comes up with the cool fact that goes in the press release.
How much energy you get? This
is fun. Somebody must have all these numbers ready to hand somewhere. That's 3 suns, that is.
Yeah. And all that if I suppose you think about it, you're effectively sort of stretching the entire universe over the course of, as the wave propagates through the universe. So so you probably need quite a lot of energy to do that when you think about it. The exciting thing is hopefully these events are going to come relatively routine. We're going to see them all the time. From that, we can slowly learn more about the systems causing them and a little bit more about the actual physics behind how gravitational waves work.
There's a little bit of a shame because I remember Martin Hendry, who's one of the higher-ups on the LIGO sort of consortium, and he was talking about an original press release, much fanfare, huge announcement, big thing, gravitational waves. We got very excited about it, did a podcast on it, and they already knew that they were only going to get one big announcement.
Yeah, because that was it.
Already it's become like, okay, we've seen another one, and it's just a matter of time to sort of stack up the detections. It's a little bit of a shame because every single one of these is interesting. I mean, like from our point of view, just wondering about what masses of black holes are even out there is something quite hard to speculate on. So this is all quite exciting. But it's going to be very hard to see those press releases coming out.
Will we discuss the third one on our podcast?
Will we
be like, yeah, they found another gravitational wave? Great.
I think it'll depend on the masses of the black holes involved.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Because it's weird to think, because I think it was my understanding that these kind of sizes of black holes, we didn't expect to find that many of them. Or am I wrong on that?
Well, no, I think the big one particularly, the first, they were definitely not expecting the first one to be 230 solar mass black holes. That is pretty extreme. It's quite hard to form a black hole of quite that size because the black holes formed at the end of the life of a big star, and you get some huge stars, but generally the huge stars kind of throw out a shed load of material throughout their lives such that their mass, when they actually finally go boom, is normally a lot lower. I mean, some people suggest there would be, but to get 2 in a system was... You thought that maybe the supernova of one explodes, if there's 2 locked together going around each other and one goes boom, it's quite possible that might disrupt the system. So the fact that the system survived well enough for it to then spiraling and I mean, it's just awesome.
I think that's fun. There's a lot of speculation because if you see a black hole, you can go, okay, this black hole. But did it form just from one progenitor star, or has it been growing as other things fallen onto it in the meantime?
And I think it's interesting that this is something we can essentially probe black holes as well. So we've had problems in the past of, you know, we can't see them obviously because they're black. But now you've actually got a chance to probe them and understand more what masses they are and what's happening, how the system has evolved. During a very short lifespan, but how systems evolved in that time, which we just haven't been able to do. And you cannot do only looking at light.
No. Yeah. You can only do it indirectly. Yeah. So the gravitational wave thing is just, it's just
so in some ways, it's the most direct measurement we have of a black hole, probably. Say everything else is inferred from the influence of the black hole on other things, whereas this is actually kind of almost the signature of the black hole itself. I
mean, yeah.
It's fantastic.
So yeah, hopefully we'll hear more LIGO detections, more gravitational wave detections.
But we won't be talking about them, no.
But what's interesting also is, I mean, LIGO has a fairly limited, as fantastic as it has a fairly limited range and detection levels that it can do. And to get a more accurate detection, to detect more things, different masses of coalescing bodies and over longer time periods, you need much bigger instruments. Much, much, much bigger instruments.
That was a very nice segue, by
Thank
the way.
And smooth.
I like what you're about to start
I've been working on this for a while. And that leads us really nicely into talking about LISA Pathfinder. So this is a mission that ESA launched, which was to test a very important part of LISA, which is a hopeful future instrument for detecting gravitational waves that will be space-based.
Yeah, so this will be... LISA would be transformative if it happens in maybe 10 odd years. But the thing that's just returned results was LISA Pathfinder, as you say. And so basically this is testing some of that technology. The basic principle of a LIGO detector or a gravitational wave detector is that you basically put a large ruler on the ground and you measure the length of that ruler. And if a gravitational wave happens to come fleeting through our part of the universe, that ruler gets stretched. And your sensitivity to the measurement is proportional to the length of the ruler. So if space is stretched by 1% and your ruler is 1 meter long, then you need to measure a shift of a centimeter. I mean, it's not. The scales we're talking about are tiny fractions of an atom. But basically, make your ruler longer and you get a more sensitive system. So LIGO has rulers of about 3 kilometers in length. It's pretty impressive. LISA will have things which are millions of kilometers, because they're going to orbit, have free flying spacecraft orbiting the sun. So your sensitivity rockets. It's fantastic. But the difficulty to do this is to keep things so you can measure that precisely. You need, the idea is to have free floating masses.
Well, you need a reference mass.
Yes.
That is essentially stationary. But it's stationary in the sense of, it's stationary in space. So it's actually in free fall. It's put in a location and then it's not touched and it will sit there and only be perturbed by the universe and by nothing else and by very small amounts, which means that you have to have your satellite, the rest of your equipment, follow that mass in any way that it moves. The rest of the satellite has to stay exactly around that mass.
Yeah. So basically if you put a mass off going around the sun, then it would get hit by the solar wind, it would get hit by micrometeorites, and its orbit around the sun wouldn't be perfect. It would have weird imperfections because it would just be being nudged, basically. And the level where the sort of precision we're talking about, which is fractions, tiny fractions of a meter, well, tiny fractions of a fraction of a meter, you see those movements. So you almost use the spacecraft as a shield to protect your mass, which is just cool, basically. And LISA has two of these masses, and the spacecraft follows one of them, and then sort of the other one stays in. Both the masses are in free fall, and the spacecraft kind of follows around one.
They had to cheat a little bit because the second mass wouldn't normally be so close to the other one, so it's it's actually easier to do the main LISA mission because you're like just all three in perfect free fall doing their thing. But this second mass, they have to sort of park next door to the one that is in perfect free fall.
Yeah, so what we're saying,
a bit fiddly for them.
In terms of lengths of rulers, LIGO on the ground is 3 kilometres. The real one in space is going to be millions of kilometres. LISA is doing exactly the same measurement, but the two the length of the ruler is about 30 centimetres, which sounds like it's not very good, but it's purely there to test the technology. And one half of one of those balls, which is on LISA, will go on one of the spacecraft 5 million kilometres away, and then we're there. Anyway, the results have come back, and it's astoundingly good.
Yeah.
Factors of tens of magnitudes or better than it was expected to be.
They under-promised and over-delivered on that one, I think, which is kind of nice.
No, and they've done a fantastic job. They've really, I mean, compared to what it was meant to be capable of, they've got hugely above that.
Yeah.
Much higher accuracy than expected, which is astounding, quite frankly.
Yeah, so some parts of it are almost ready to plug and play in the real craft. Even to the degree that I think apparently ESA have been talking about whether they can bring LISA forward a little bit.
Yeah.
LISA was originally planned for 2034-ish. And now they're sort of thinking, could they do it by the end of the 2020s? Yeah. That's what I'd heard anyway.
I think that's the rumour. I think because of LIGO actually detecting gravitational waves and confirming that these are a genuine thing now, LISA's like, well, if we put this thing up there, we're going to detect a hell of a lot more. This will work. Yeah. This is a great thing. And Pathfinder worked, well, we know the technology works. Everything's there. All the pieces are in place. Just a case of sticking them together and getting it up there.
Mm. And we've just seen, I mean, LISA will be amazing. I mean, for instance, I think one of the most amazing ideas I heard about LISA was that in comparison to LIGO, I mean, don't get me wrong, LIGO is utterly brilliant in what it's done. It's the first time it's this been done. It's very impressive. But for instance, those two black holes which collided in the first press release, which were exciting and wonderful, if you had had LISA in operation, you'd have known about 10 years before the collision. Yeah. So for 10 years, you'd have been sitting watching these masses spiral in, going, right, they're going to collide, and you'd have been able to predict it to within a few seconds.
Well, yeah, it was within 10 seconds.
Yeah.
If you had LISA, you could predict that collision of black holes to within 10 seconds and then compare that to the data that comes out of LIGO.
Yeah.
And would have given you higher accuracy in locating it.
And every ground-based telescope in the world would have been pointing at that patch of the sky just in case we saw something.
Yeah. I think the location accuracy is going to be the next huge thing.
That's true.
Because there's so many people excited about the prospect of catching some kind of an afterglow. I mean, yes, you have two black holes falling into one another, but there might be extra stuff around about them, extra bits of material that get thrown out when this happens. So, you know, being able to see this kind of thing would be fantastic. But at the moment, the error bars are a quarter of the sky.
Yeah, it's somewhere over there.
Well, there is the Indian LIGO that's going to come online in the next few years, hopefully.
I forgot about that.
And that'll give you a third thing so you can locate it. But because you only get the last few seconds of the collision, if you're going to look for it with an EM telescope, you're going to get lucky to catch it as opposed to 10 years of going, it's going to be there and we can give you the time and date and location of it. Yeah. So point your telescope here within this 10-second window.
Yeah.
And that'll be a game changer.
Yeah. And the other thing that's really exciting is that this is, we're talking about detecting smallish solar mass size black holes in the relatively nearby universe, but that LISA has the potential to see the largest black holes, so supermassive black holes you find at the center of all galaxies, when they were colliding, when galaxies are forming, ten billion years ago. So LISA is going to give us this view of the entire universe, pretty much the history of the universe at once. You're going to see events all the time. I mean, I think actually one of the intriguing problems for it is going to be seeing so much that you're going to have to distinguish what exactly, picking out all the needles from the haystack of this stuff happening everywhere all the time.
It'll be the equivalent of an astronomer trying to peer through the atmosphere to see twinkly things that are very far away. Just the atmosphere smooshes it all together, and then the universe needs to just be still for a while and let us see what's going on.
I think a needle in a haystack's not a fair comparison, because a needle in a needle stack.
yes, it's true.
Yeah. It's going to be quite a data processing challenge. Moving away from the gravitational wave information, there's also been an interesting thing in the news, a slightly more legal matter, I suppose.
Lawyers, yay.
talking about the moon. So, Ali, do you want to, as our resident moon expert...
Yes, I will not try and sell you any pieces of the moon, I promise. I'm not so familiar with the news story itself, but I thought it would be a good time to sort of mention the fact that we're coming to the end of the Google Lunar X Prize competition. So this is something that, to much fanfare, appeared in 2007. And if you go to their website, it's fantastic, because they've clearly spent quite a lot of money on it, making it look all shiny and glitzy. You sort of, this is where you get the dramatic music to play underneath you. And it's 16 teams, 238,900 miles, one dream. And the from that original 16 teams, what they've been asking for this X prize, potentially up to $30 million up for grabs for the first prize, is you have to, using privately funded money, you have to launch a spacecraft to place a robot onto the moon. That robot then has to drive 500 meters and also transmit HD video back to the Earth. So HD video and moon makes Ali excited because we didn't have HD when the Apollo guys were there. So this is really fun. But from that original 16 teams, we're down to two of them who have met all the goals so far that Google have sort of set them. So we're now in 2016. To still be in the running for the competition, by the end of this year, you have to have shown the Google guys that your rocket is ready to launch, you have a launch contract in place, your payload is going to go on to said rocket. And only two teams have been able to confirm that so far. So that's Space IL and Moon Express. It's maybe Space Hill, they might shout at me if I'm pronouncing that wrong.
It's got to be Space IL.
And there's a third one, Astrobotic, they're talking about maybe hoping to have their one confirmed. So we're down to just three teams, but this competition ends end of 2017. So the fun is going to start in the next few months or so. So keep an eye out in the news for if any of these teams are actually attempting to launch. But as with all things spacey, if you put your very expensive probe on top of a rocket that maybe hasn't flown often before, some of these teams are using brands of rocket I've not heard of before. So I'm still waiting to see how reliable they are. If that rocket happens to explode on the way into space, there is no do-overs. You're unlikely to have enough money to do your backup and launch something
else.
You're
going to rebuild it before the end of 2017.
But it's going to be hella exciting to see what happens with these three teams. And yeah, I mean, $30 million sounds like a big prize pot, and it is. But given that a lot of these teams are investing at least that much into getting there in the first place, it's actually more about trying to sort of kickstart this private space exploration.
Prestige that you want, isn't it?
Yeah, I think.
If you're
the
first company to successfully do it, that's probably worth a lot to your company.
Or is it, though? What does your company then do?
I think it's the prestige thing, it's the ego thing, and it's also just that, well, you know, if you can get a rover to land on the moon, and you've shown your launcher can do that, well, the talk about going to asteroids to mine them,
that's
going
true.
To mine them, well, you say, well, I've already done it. Who else can say that?
We landed on the moon, that's an asteroid. Might take you a bit longer to get there, but it's
And getting onto the moon is expensive. I mean, if you sort of factor in how much it costs to launch probes or humans to the moon, it's at least $1 million or $2 million per kilo of stuff you want to send. Mm-hmm. So if these private companies can do this, it's probably going to be an order of magnitude less is what they're spending on it. So if they can do anything at all that comes close to meeting the terms of the prize, then it's going to be fantastic because all of a sudden I can start planning my moon vacation in retirement, you know. And maybe that's a little bit over-optimistic, do you think?
Maybe. It's also an interesting thing to consider because with the Russian lunar rover program during the space race, those guys were contacted after the Chernobyl disaster to build remote control bulldozers to clear it up because they had the expertise to build robotic machines that can work at a long range and do this, well, do remote work and that kind of style with good cameras and all the rest. So the expertise you develop in developing this sort of thing probably has real-world applications that we haven't yet thought of.
Let's hope not.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, okay. Hopefully different applications.
Well, it's hard to quantify the spin-offs, isn't it? Because whatever you're doing to, you're throwing something millions of kilometres away or whatever, but ultimately that technology has been useful and you can apply it elsewhere. I mean, speaking of nuclear reactors, high radiation environments, you've got the Juno probe arriving very soon at Jupiter. So we'll probably talk about more about Juno later, but it was interesting. I was reading a story today about it's the highest radiation environment a spacecraft has had to endure in the solar system thus far. So it's getting awfully close to Jupiter's magnetic field, huge amounts of charged particles above Jupiter, and they have to try and, it's essentially, they compared it to something like 1 million dental x-rays equivalent dosage for the spacecraft, and they're trying to keep it alive in this very nasty environment. So it's interesting that you do need to know how to shield your spacecraft as well. So we'll talk about Juno later.
But on the topic of planets, if those of you who are keen on observing, currently is a good time to look at the moon, I would have said, and also other planets.
Yes, so Mars and Saturn have just passed opposition, which means they're kind of closest point to, if you kind of close point to the Earth. So if you imagine the planets on a racetrack, it's kind of the Earth is just kind of overtaking on the inside lane, which means that the point it was overtaking them, then they're close by, whereas you imagine kind of later on in the race, they're around the other side of the track. Mm. That's possibly a strange analogy to try and draw, but you see what I mean. They were close and they were bright. So you might have noticed in the evening skies, Mars has been particularly bright, red and shiny at the moment, which is rather wonderful.
Yeah,
and Saturn is at peak viewing time. The rings are tilted towards us. It's just looking lovely.
It's a big tilt on the rings right now as well, really good. So that doesn't always happen.
If you've got a telescope, get it on Saturn. Yeah. You will be amazed.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful sight.
Yeah, and Jupiter's...
Jupiter's always looking good.
And it's setting in the west.
Yeah, it's getting a little bit low now, but it's nicer for evening time observers, yeah. Which tends to be when people are more keen to go out before it gets cold. And the nice thing about the planets is that they're bright enough to see from rubbishy, bright sky Scotland at this time of year. This is technically Milky Way season. The summertime is when we're sort of tilted towards the middle bit of your Milky Way galaxy. But the sky in Scotland doesn't really, you don't even get to what's called astronomical dark. There's just always a tiny bit of twilight left behind.
Yeah.
And that's a bit depressing if you want to chase these faint and fuzzy things. But if you go further south, you might be okay from seeing the Milky Way.
But planets are big and bright. So if you're sitting out having your barbecue in the evening with a couple of beers and you see bright things in the sky, either stop having beer or it's a nice shiny planet to look at.
Yeah, and don't ring the observatory and say, what's the strange red ring in the sky? Because we've just told you. There's no excuse. You'll just be directed here.
So the last thing to talk about very briefly would be an upcoming event in Edinburgh in a couple of weeks' time, which is very important to William and I, particularly, which is the SPIE Astronomical Telescope and Technology Conference.
Something like that.
That's what it's called. It's quite a long name.
Does the SPIE stand for something, or do you just pronounce it
SPIE? Society of Photonics
and yeah. Excellence. Or a bit, it's Latin, in extremis.
You can say SPIE, which is also good, because then you go into a SPIE conference.
Oh, that's classier. Yeah. It's way better than SPIE.
I mean, this event, probably, to be honest, has very little bearing on most people's lives, which is totally fair enough. But the reason we're excited and the reason we're mentioning it is because it's pretty much the largest conference for telescope building folk. It happens every couple of years and is in various parts of the world, and they sort of rotate it around, they move it about, and it happens to be arriving in Edinburgh for us this coming month. Mm-hmm. Which is awesome, because there's going to be a couple of thousand engineers and excited telescopy people arriving in Edinburgh to talk about a whole range of projects sort of. And it's great meeting, because you have people talking about things which have been done, and here are our results. We've put it on Sky. It's great. And then you also have sort of sessions where there's people saying, we'd like to do something completely ridiculous, and it's going to take us years, and we don't have any money or actually idea how we'd do it. But they kind of get the full scope of the minutiae of detail about a particular bonding system in a detector through to, why don't we put telescopes in the Antarctic? It's great. Yeah. So in that respect.
Do you have highlights? I mean, I'm assuming you're attending a lot of this.
Yeah, I think the best bit will be, there's a talk about moons on Wednesday at something like 2:40.
Moons, that would be that thing that you're part of.
That might be the one I'm part of, and the talk I'm giving.
I would consider that a highlight.
No, the speaker that's giving that talk is just awful.
He hasn't written his slides yet.
There's a lot of talks from locally going on, but if you look at the sort of list of conferences that are on, there's ones on detectors, there's ones on possible missions, there's ones on cyber infrastructure, which just sounds amazing. There's a whole section on the adaptive optics and the active optics. There's a whole section on optics manufacturing that I'm really looking forward to going to.
Geek on there.
I can't wait for that one. it's just so, there's so much, you can't do everything. And you have to, it's a week, just over a week?
Six days.
Yeah.
I've been to one of these before, and I hadn't realised until going to that just how, in some ways, how large the astronomical instrumentation community is. It really, actually there's a lot of people in a lot of countries doing stuff like this. I mean, actually in reality it's still only maybe 10,000 people in the world doing it, but it's, which is not that many, but just seeing everyone together like that is kind of quite exciting.
It's pretty cool. Is there like a known handshake between astronomical instrumentation types, you know, so you can sort of have a nod to people?
If we told you we'd have to kill you.
Not part of that club yet.
If you come over to the dark side of engineering, then you can find out.
I think it's only a matter of time.
So that'll be us in a couple of weeks' time. Hopefully we'll try and get some more information for our podcasts at that event as well.
Yeah, should we wish Tim Peake luck as well?
Oh, yes.
Within about 24 hours he's going to be coming home.
So by time you'll
much fanfare,
to this.
I think.
Yeah.
So fingers crossed that all goes well.
Well done, Tim. Good work.
Yeah. Well, we should maybe do a summary of everything he got up to as well for one of the next podcasts, I think.
I think we will do. Okay, well, thank you very much for listening. We'll call it there.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
See you later.